Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt. Hi, welcome to Willing to Adapt. I am Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
And Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
This is our special episode for the Christmas season, and today we are going to be talking about what, Romy?
We are talking about Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol.
Exactly. So there are many, many, many variations on the story of A Christmas Carol, and we could be here and have a whole podcast about A Christmas Carol if we really wanted to, but
yes,
we're not doing that, so... Today, specifically, we're going to talk about the Jim Carrey version of A Christmas Carol. To be fair, that's the Robert Zemeckis-directed version.
Yes.
From 2009. And we were going to originally talk about a few other adaptations as well, but as it goes, we started to run out of time. So, we wanted to get this one out there as quickly as we could for the Yuletide season. And so, maybe stick around next year, and you might get a Muppet Christmas Carol.
Or my favorite, Mickey's Christmas Carol.
All right. So I think A Christmas Carol is one of those stories that kind of goes without saying almost everybody's seen a version of it. If they haven't read the book, they've seen some sort of adaptation. Would you agree?
Definitely. It's something that I think many shows, TV shows, everything across the board, stories, books, musicals, they've done different adaptations of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And so, I don't even think we need to go that in-depth on the plot.
True. I mean, the summary is very simple.
I'm just going to take the one from Wikipedia because it's short and simple and to the point.
Go for it.
So, A Christmas Carol, in prose, being a ghost story of Christmas, also commonly known as A Christmas Carol, is a novella by Charles Dickens, first published in London by Chapman and Hall in 1843 and illustrated by John Leech. It recounts the story of Ebenezer Scrooge, an elderly miser who is visited by the ghost of his former business partner, Jacob Marley, and the spirits of Christmas past, present, and yet to come. In the process, Scrooge is transformed into a kinder, gentler man and learns the spirit of the season.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. That's all we get today. For anybody who is completely unfamiliar with A Christmas Carol... You can look up your own plot.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to sum it up and just say, stingy old man, three ghosts, changed his life at the end.
The end.
The end, pretty much.
I think people forget how scary the story is.
You know what? It doesn't surprise me. After reading it, I was pleasantly surprised.
At how scary it was?
Yeah. It's. I think because all I tend to watch, so there's so much Christmas stuff on these days,
mm-hmm.
I usually don't watch an adaptation every year except for Mickey's Christmas Carol, which I mean, yeah, I guess for kids you could say perhaps it's a bit
intense. It also helps it's only like 27 minutes long.
Yeah, it does. And so in watching the film version and in reading it, I was a little not surprised, I just reminded, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's right. I've never read any of his other ghost stories, so I don't know
sure.
what they're like.
Yeah, it's funny. There's a lot of literature in the Victorian period that deals with like characters like goblins and ghosts and things.
Mm-hmm.
And people kind of forget about that the Victorians were definitely interested in some of those things.
Yeah, because I have heard recently someone read on their podcast, I think it was The Monkey's Paw,
uh-huh.
which I believe is from that era.
Right.
And they were discussing the ghost stories of then or the horror stories back then. And I mean, from a literary perspective, it was an intense story. I think we're often desensitized with our movies and TV shows and stuff like that.
So desensitized by film and television.
Unfortunately. But when you let it just kind of sit with the story, especially when someone is nicely narrating it, it can be a bit chilling.
So it's kind of fun because the people sometimes are surprised by some of the darker elements of A Christmas Carol. And
mm-hmm.
when you look at other stories... Charles Dickens has a story that he wrote, I read it once, called, I think, The Chimes.
Yes.
And it's also a Christmas story, but it deals with a bunch of goblins that come out at Christmas time. And that's something that people also have kind of forgotten about the Victorian Christmas, is this idea of Christmas goblins.
Mm.
And I know it sounds so weird for modern ears, but there was this idea in the time, especially back in the day, you know, when you didn't have electricity and stuff. So in darkness, it was a lot darker.
Oh, yeah.
And so in the winter season, when it would get darker sooner in the day, there was this idea that people had that was when, like, ghosts could come out more. Because, yeah, like, the line between the living and the dead was limited, and that was, like, the idea of that sort of thing.
Yeah, you still see that in some literature, usually, like, Celtic literature, about right before the sun rises.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the two worlds are at their closest.
Right. Mm-hmm. But apparently, because, you know, we celebrate Christmas a little differently now, whereas back in the day, you didn't really start celebrating Christmas until Christmas Eve.
Correct. It's Advent season.
Yeah, but then they would celebrate Christmas up until almost February.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason they did that was because they decorated and they had celebrations to help get themselves through the winter season.
Mm.
That way you had all these decorations up in the darkness and to keep your cheerfulness up and that sort of thing.
Was gift giving a big thing at that point? Do you know?
It was.
Okay.
And if we're speaking about when Dickens wrote the story, gift giving was a thing, but it became a bigger thing after.
Okay.
Yeah. So we can go a little bit into that if you want. So the idea of Christmas, I don't know how much, do you know a whole lot about the history of Christmas?
Not really. I mean, I've read like some stories here and there in a couple books, but nothing too in depth.
So it's actually quite kind of interesting because our understanding of Christmas now is heavily based off of the Victorians and specifically Charles Dickens, obviously.
Okay.
But also a lot of our current understanding of Christmas is also very molded by a lot of what has come out of like the 1940s and 50s here in America.
The advertising period.
Well, advertising, but also the music and stuff. But we'll get a little, I'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
So just very briefly, so people are interested. So Christmas, obviously, you know, we celebrate Christmas because of the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
To start with that one. Christmas wouldn't happen if it wasn't for that. Obviously, you know, there's some pagan cultural holidays, like obviously like Saturnalia that we get pull things from that. And, you know, decorating with greenery and things like that has always been around because, you know, you want to put things up that last forever.
Mm-hmm.
So even the Egyptians have put up, you know, evergreen plants for celebrations.
Mm.
But, you know, Christmas, like actual Christmas for Christians, was celebrated in the medieval period, but it wasn't like what we think of now. And Easter was always a much bigger celebration because, you know, the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Correct.
So so there was a period of time, even in the medieval period, in the late medieval period, where Christmas was basically banned by the church because a lot of celebrations kind of just got out of hand and got a little bit more focused on, like, hedonism and focused more on pagan cultures and things like that. And so, you know, the Catholic Church put the kibosh on that for a good while. And it didn't help that even in England, the Puritans were very against the celebration of Christmas. But
I remember coming across that one time.
Yeah. But that's why Christmas didn't take off in America until like later in the 1800s, because we still have, and to this day, arguably in parts of America, we have a lot of traditions that are very puritanical.
Yeah.
But the Christmas tree obviously comes from the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And Prince Albert was not the first one to introduce the Christmas tree to England, but he's the one that was able to be successful in making it stick.
Okay.
For a very long time, Christmas was this idea of, you know, generosity and taking care of each other, like, at its core, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's always kind of been the idea of it. But I think also this kind of goes to every major holiday.
Yeah.
And so there's a YouTuber we talked about once before named Jay Draper. She's, I think she's a historian, but she's, we talked about her when we did My Fair Lady.
Okay.
And she has an episode where she talks about how accurate is Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh,
and we can talk about that when we talk about Muppet Christmas Carol another time.
Mm-hmm.
But she did talk about how when Charles Dickens was writing A Christmas Carol, he was trying to, in some ways, look back to a lot of the older traditions of Christmas that we don't celebrate now. Because when he wrote A Christmas Carol, the idea of Christmas was slowly changing into what we kind of recognize it as now.
Mm-hmm.
And Christmas was only beginning to see a revitalization in, specifically, England.
Yeah.
So much so that when he wrote A Christmas Carol, people were wondering why he said it at Christmas time. But there was the idea, you know, under like feudalism, that on holidays, the landlord would, whether that be like a nobility or whatever, the landlord would take in people from his land, and during the celebrations would feed them and include them and take care of them and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's that generosity aspect there. And so in some ways, J. Draper was saying that, in a nutshell, Charles Dickens was trying to get back to some of those traditions and stuff, whereas those people during the Industrial Revolution had moved away from farms and stuff and now were working in factories and in dirty cities and far away from small communities that they used to know and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, that's the gist of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of that I did hear it did wane at some point, and then it came back about the Victorian era, but that was pretty much all mm-hmm. I knew.
The Time had written an article called How Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol Changed the Way the Holiday Celebrated. And it said that the festival fell out of favor, except in little pockets of the countryside, including the rural area where Dickens lived as a young boy before his family moved to London. But having come from the countryside, he had a lot of these traditions that had become lost in the city.
Mm. So interestingly enough, one of the videos I watched was more on what spurred him to write A Christmas Carol.
Oh, yes.
But I could not understand, like, and the author of the video never really explained why he ended up utilizing Christmas. Mm-hmm. So what I did find is that he was, you know, like you said, it was an Industrial Revolution. People had moved to the city, and a report had just come out. I don't remember the name of the report, but it was basically about children being forced to work in dangerous jobs. Mm-hmm. And so it spurred him. Oh, actually, here it is. It's a report on the condition and treatment of the children employed in the mines and collieries of the United Kingdom. And it heavily influenced him. And so he basically kind of wanted to start raising awareness of this and mm-hmm. to raise money. So he decided to create a book.
Right. And he did a lot with many of his books, where he would look at the plights of the current culture, mm-hmm. and whether that be the orphans or the poor, working houses, so on. He always had something to say to help yeah. people to change things and reform.
Yeah, especially because, like, I didn't realize this till afterwards, but the Cratchits live in, was it Camden Town?
Yes.
And that's where he lived when he was a kid. And then how his parents, I don't remember if we mentioned this during Nicholas Nickleby, but his parents were thrown in debtor's prison. Mm-hmm. And so he was forced to go to work and
provide. A bootblack factory.
Is that what it was?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, and it was rough because he essentially had to pay off the debt to get his father out of debtor's prison.
Mm-hmm. And so at the time he wrote A Christmas Carol, he was already a fairly well-known author at this point.
Uh-huh.
But the problem was,
because he had already written Charles Dickens. I mean, he had already written Oliver Twist.
Correct, yeah. But the problem was he didn't have a lot of money still, and he needed to raise more, because the professor I was listening to talked about how the problems that people face today when they come into money sometimes are they're eternal. And so Dickens was always having to bail his dad out, who was not good at saving and wisely spending money. Mm-hmm. He had relatives who would come in. He had, you know, more children. He bought a nice house, which he had to upkeep. And so the funds were going by. Mm-hmm. And then he decides to raise money for poor children, for the ones who work in the mines and stuff. And it was actually kind of a cool story. I don't know if you came across this, about how he created his copies of Christmas, the first editions. They were these nicely hardcover. And this is, you know, this is when a lot of, like Nicholas Nickleby was, what, newspapers?
Mm-hmm.
Or in like magazine type stuff,
yeah,
where they would
serialized.
Read it as serialized. Yeah. And so he created, the first editions were beautifully done, but he didn't want to sell them at a high price. So he ended up losing money because they were so expensive to make,
right.
But he didn't want to charge because he wanted everyone to read it. And so he really did not, he broke even, but he barely. And sometimes he was talking about how his generosity kind of kept him from getting rich, basically.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because one of the things I came across in regards to him is, because of his upbringing where he really had to deal with a lot of hardship, mm-hmm. and being poor and you know, difficult relationship with his family and his father and everything. He was very frugal at times, and he would complain about like the housekeeping and everything. But then at other times, he would flip, or he would flip, and he would just like go out and buy like the fanciest clothes. Because I think it's difficult, because like when you grow up and you don't have a lot of money, and all of a sudden you come into money, all of a sudden you just start spending because you have it. So that was one of the things I came across with him, is like he was a very flashy dresser, and he always wanted the best things for like the house and things like that. But then he would also turn around and be like, we got to save money. And
yeah, he had a tumultuous relationship with his finances, if anything.
Yes.
So, but it made sense. And then the other things that I read about in regards to the book, not so much about him per se, but is that, I did notice this in reading it. I haven't read much Dickens. I've skimmed a few things. I've read some short stories. But I think the only books I've ever read were Great Expectations and Nicholas Nickleby.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was very different.
It does feel different, right?
It does.
And well, I think because it's not serialized.
That's part of it. But I... So the video I watched, he talked about the genre.
Uh-huh.
So there was a lot of genres back then that don't exist anymore.
Sure.
And
we also have a lot of stupid, crazy genres now.
Yeah.
And, go on Netflix.
Yeah, definitely. And so he was talking about how this one was, it was a bunch of different genres mixed together, which was something that was unusual for the time. So it was definitely a ghost story, as he tells us. But it was also what they called a conversion narrative.
Correct.
And then a dream vision, and then a work of realism that portrayed the gritty life of London to some degree. But then which this one threw me off when I was reading it, is it's a literary carol.
Uh-huh.
Because it's divided into the musical staves.
Right, yeah.
Which I
But that's why he says it's a Christmas carol in prose.
Yeah, which
because a carol, which is funny. Would not be in prose traditionally.
Correct.
Because you sing it and it rhymes. And so it would be in a meter, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But when you speak normally or you write normally, it's in prose.
Okay.
So I think that's why it's a Christmas carol in prose.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's really fun about the book is that it published on the 19th of December and it sold out by Christmas Eve. But like the book's never been out of print.
So, but in overall, I never realized, like, because we're so inundated with adaptations of it and or even hearing it or reading it, that we don't realize how certain things that we take for granted were a little novel for their time.
Oh, well, yeah. When you're outside the context, it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I like knowing the context. It adds something to the story.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. So when was the first time you read it?
Thank you. That was something I usually ask you. You know what's funny is I don't remember the first time I read it, because I think one of the first adaptations I ever watched was Mickey's Christmas Carol.
Okay.
I had it on VHS. But I think the first time I read it might have been in high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I went through a period of my life where I tried to read all the stories that I loved watching the film versions of.
Oh, that's actually kind of cool.
Yeah.
Cool idea.
And sometimes I liked them and sometimes I didn't. And so A Christmas Carol was fun because there's a lot more in it, obviously compared to Mickey's Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
But other than like some of the older films, because I didn't grow up with the Muppet Christmas Carol. So
okay.
I came in that one. I only started knowing that one in high school because other people started talking about it.
Okay.
So I really was only familiar with Mickey's Christmas Carol, and I was aware of like the older black and white film. And now I'm at a point in my life where I read it almost every year at Christmas time.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's not that long. It's only like 97 pages.
It's not. And I read it for the first time in my 20s. So that would have been, what, the early 2000s? And I had a hard time reading it back then. But
sure.
I don't know what what I read, because I reread it again this time, and there were pieces missing.
There's stuff you remember that no longer in it?
I could have sworn, like, maybe I read...
You made it up.
No, the only thing I could think of is that maybe I read a second story that he wrote afterwards, and my mind blended the two together. So this time around, I enjoyed it a lot more than I did back then. So it's the second time...
So is this your first time reading it
since then? Second time reading it.
Okay. A lot of time's passed.
Yeah, it's been about 20 years.
Wow.
25 years.
Did you enjoy it?
I really did. So now that we read Did Nicholas Nickleby First, going backwards to something smaller helped me appreciate it a lot more. There were some little things that I'm like, okay, that's just a little archaic.
Sure. I mean, and definitely the way that they speak. And
yeah. But, or things where I'm just like, I'm not quite sure what they're talking about. You know, like his calves shine like moons or something. I mean, there's little things where you're just
He means exactly what he means.
I'm like, what the heck are you talking about?
He had really white calves.
His calves were showing while dancing?
Yeah.
That's it. It's funny. Know. And then the one thing I did find jarring, though, and I think what added to the ghostly aspect of it, the creepy aspect, was the... I don't remember the descriptions of the ghost from the last time I read it.
Okay.
So rereading it this time, between the three ghosts, at least the first ghost.
Yeah.
And then the creepy children and the second ghost.
Yeah. That's the one that not everybody does.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the last one's just like the Grim Reaper. So.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now that I'm a lot more, well-read in classics, there are little... things I caught this time around that I don't know if they were intentional, but may have been allusions to other works.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the biblical stuff was a little evident.
Yeah.
But the other one was, I think I came across maybe two or three different what may have been allusions to, like, Dante's Inferno.
Oh, okay.
So, for instance...
It's possible.
I mean, yeah, because it was, like, I loved his description of two things about Scrooge. One is he's not a stereotypical evil man. He is just... a man who's been hardened with time, but has the propensity for a conversion, hence the conversion genre.
Yeah, he's not like a villain per se, so much as he's just allowed himself to be so isolated and greedy that he just doesn't want anything to do with people.
Correct.
And so when people get in his way, he gets angry.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you see that with a lot of people these days, especially the older we get.
And it's funny, there's this misconception that Scrooge hates Christmas.
Because
in the book, he doesn't actually hate Christmas. He just doesn't see the point of it.
Yeah, it's the materialism. Yeah. The fact, you know, like,
and so, like, if he could work on Christmas, he would work on Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because even J. Draper says this too, that even though he's upset that he has to let Cratchit have the whole day off, he's still going to pay him for it.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing I loved in the description of Scrooge was his coldness. And how, like, I think there's even a line that talks about how whether it was hot or cold, it didn't bother him. He was just, his lips were blue. You know, he didn't use coal, whether it was winter or if it was hot, it was hot. Didn't matter.
Yeah, I liked that he didn't register the cold.
Yes. And that's where one of the things where I wondered if it was an allusion to Dante, because in Dante's Inferno, the last level is hell. It's the last circle is hell, and that's where Satan is. And it's not hot, as most people conceptualize it in his version. Hell is frozen.
Uh-huh.
And frozen is the absence of love. It's the absence of happiness. And so I was wondering if that's what Dickens was implying here was, you know, yeah, he wasn't evil, but love and happiness were so absent from him that the cold didn't even bother him.
It's possible. You know? I also kind of thought it was just a really interesting literary method.
I believe I looked it up. Not that one in particular, but as a literary method, people tend to... It stems from that tradition of hell being frozen.
Maybe.
It's more of a trope that was from back in that era, but I wasn't sure if that's what he was implying.
Yeah, well, even with Scrooge, he doesn't let Bob Cratchit like light more coal because he's freezing, and he expects everybody to like live super frugally, but like also give him the money and stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like he also like he lives by his words. So.
Yeah.
Like, he eats very humbly, and he lives humbly, and he doesn't spend money he doesn't need to, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And the only other thing that he threw in there that might have also been a reference to something from that time was the line about the poor. You know, if the surplus population, just let them die off.
Uh-huh.
I just watched another documentary on a guy called Malthus, Malthusianism, which is that the world's going to become so populated. Overpopulated, lack of resources, that we eventually will just need to let people die off.
That was a concern for the time.
I was wondering about that, yeah.
That was a definite concern because when you think about from a history standpoint, specifically at this point in time, London was the most populated city in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And many people had moved to London, and people were continuing to move to London, especially because of the Industrial Revolution. And so it was becoming very overcrowded and dirty and seedy and so on. And so there was this general concern that the country was not going to be able to feed their own, and that they were going to have to start relying on other countries. And in part, you can make the argument that's why, you know, they started pursuing imperialism more. But there was this concern that the country was going to outgrow what they could take care of. And so the phrase surplus population had been thrown around before. And so people at the time would have recognized that phrase when Scrooge said it.
Yeah.
And so for him, it was instead the question of the surplus population to him was to just let them die.
Yeah.
Which is horrible.
Yes, it is.
But it goes to show you where his heart's at, right?
So. It's a very, hey, this is the way it is, very factual. We have to accept it. Who cares? And another thing it speaks to kind of is I did a little research because I was curious about where Dickens' religious beliefs were at the time. And the source I read, it was he basically said that he considered himself a Christian, but he really didn't like authoritative.
Sure.
He didn't establish.
He didn't like the traditional like English church.
Yeah.
Which is the Anglican church.
Correct.
Yeah. But which to be fair is also in many ways very Catholic still.
Yeah. Yeah, so. It is. And so in turn he accepted a lot of he did like the tradition the gospel and what it stood for.
Right.
In fact, recently at a library bookstore, I came across a copy of, I don't know if it's a gospel story. It's the Birth of Christ, if I remember right. I haven't read it yet. I just bought it. And it's by Dickens. And he wrote it for his children. So it was a rewriting, an adaptation of the Birth of Christ, the life of Christ. And I believe it goes to his death.
Yeah, there was a Christian movie that came out with not too long ago that is an animated version of all that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so that was something that what I read about informed his writing of The Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
And kind of the anti-surplus population, like, okay, but that just because we're growing, it doesn't mean we still need to treat with happiness and kindness and stuff like that.
Yeah, one of the things I came across in regards to his personal beliefs is that they were his personal beliefs.
Yeah.
Like his faith was personal to him, and he had very mixed opinions in regards to church in general. But like he was very devoted to the New Testament.
Yeah,
and he took it to heart a lot. And so it's also difficult to live in England in that time period and not be exposed to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I thought was really interesting for him is how often, you know, the Christian themes do enter into his stories, you know, overtly or subtly. But in this one, for sure, this one specifically will point to Jesus or scripture several times.
Yeah, no, it does. And I appreciated that. It was a very refreshing work.
Well, and I liked the part where he kind of calls out people who will do things in the name of Jesus, but are doing it falsely, like people who
the end of the cloth. I think he says second ghost,
but they just, it's all in word only. Like they don't do it to take care of people or whatever.
Yeah. No, I'm glad we read it. Is there anything else you want to talk about
specifically for the book?
For the book.
No, I think there'll probably be some stuff to think about when we move on to the movie, but that's. I think it's really fun. There's definitely a couple times in the book where it's you can really see Dickens' turn of phrase in the book.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun. He writes in a very interesting way. I think one of my favorite parts in the beginning is when he starts talking about Marley. He's got one of the best book openings.
Yes.
Marley was dead to begin with.
Yes.
It's like, this must be completely understood or else nothing will seem miraculous or whatever he says, you know? But then he says he was as dead as a doornail. And he's like, why he has to be a doornail, I don't know. I didn't come up with that phrase. And he's like, a coffin nail makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
So like, there's things that he writes that I'm like, I see you, Charles. But he's fun how he writes sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's fun. That's something that you miss out in a lot of adaptations because it's no longer the written form.
Correct.
When we talk about Muppet Christmas Carol, we'll talk a little bit about that, because by having Gonzo as the narrator, it actually includes a lot of what is missing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, I think for now, I think that's it for the book. Mm-hmm. So, shall we move on?
Let's move on.
All right. So the adaptation today, we already said, is the 2009 CGI, the motion capture version of Robert Zemeckis's A Christmas Carol, starring Jim Carrey, with many, many, many other people in there, including Gary Oldman, Colin Firth, Bob Hoskins, Robin Wright, and Carrie Elwes. And it was obviously produced and created through the Disney Company, with music by Alan Silvestri. It was released on November 3rd, 2009 in London, and then very soon after in America. And it had a budget of $175 to $200 million. But the box office was $325.3 million, which always sounds good on paper, but also by Hollywood standards means it didn't do well.
Yeah.
And just real quick, I'll just say the movie didn't make as much as it could have because so much money went into the production of it.
Mm.
This movie is actually part of the reason why they don't do motion capture anymore.
Okay.
There was a weird phase in the early 2000s where people were trying to do the motion capture.
That was Polar Express.
It was Polar Express, but then they did Monster House.
Which I don't remember.
I seen it. It was good.
Okay.
I mean, it's weird, but it's good.
And Beowulf?
Yeah, Beowulf.
I never saw that either.
It's weird, but whatever.
Yeah.
So when's the first time you watched this adaptation?
So I tried to remember. I know I had seen it before. I actually messaged my daughter last night, and she agreed that we watched it maybe when she was like 10 or so. So that would have been maybe, what, 8 years ago?
Uh-huh.
And 8, 9, maybe 10 years ago. And the only thing I remembered from it was him being tiny and a mouse and like running around and stuff like that.
Really memorable.
I know. Yeah. And so it did not stick in my conscious spec self, my back, what do you
Your
call
subconscious.
It? Subconscious.
So is this the first time you've watched it, basically?
Yeah, I guess in some ways, yeah. Because all of a sudden I'm like, wow, I don't remember that. I don't remember that.
So did you watch this after reading the book?
Yes, this time
good,
around.
Good, good, good.
I did.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
Because this is one of the times where it helps to have read the book first.
Yes.
And I only say that because this is one of the few versions that is very close to the book, in my opinion.
Okay, yeah.
There's a lot of things that they include in this one that a lot of other adaptations omit.
And I did get to watch the deleted scenes.
Yes, I saw those too.
Okay.
So they were going to be even closer.
It was. It would have been so much more closer.
Yeah,
much
and the
closer.
Fact that they put so much work into it like meant that they intended to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's some that I'm glad they took out. Like, it didn't really need to be in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was pretty impressed because I didn't even realize that they were going to cover those scenes.
Yeah. No, I agree. I was a little hesitant at first.
What, to watch it or?
Just because I'm not sure in the past.
Okay.
I'm sure I've talked about my opinion regarding Jim Carrey.
Uh-huh.
And even though I did like him in The
Grinch.
Unfortunate Children and reluctantly in The Grinch.
When you don't even know it's him.
Yes. I was afraid.
Did you say The Reluctant
I
Children?
Did, the Unfortunate Children.
A series of unfortunate events.
Yes. I was afraid he was going to be over the top.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was afraid of because I'm like, I
and he really wasn't.
He wasn't.
No.
I could see how it could have, but I thought, you know what? He did a pretty good job on this.
So I watched this in theaters when it came out.
Oh, wow.
I loved it. It's definitely a spectacle.
Mm.
It definitely really leans into how can we make this visually exciting.
Yeah.
And so I think just right now, I'll say right now to get out of the way, I think there is a disconnect in the film in that it really wants to be true to the story and to the themes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And yet, it also seems like there was somebody at the same time going, but how can we make it extra exciting?
Yes.
And so in some ways, it kind of detracted from the story. Mm-hmm. But in other ways, I think it also elevated the story. So I think it just really depended. I think they had a disconnect in tone at times. But I'll tell you right now, I love the film.
Okay.
I think I've watched it every Christmas almost since it came out.
Wow.
Yeah. And part of that is because I love the book. And so it's really fun to watch a version that is so close to the book and not even just in the story, but in like seeing like London come to life and I mean, not all the costumes are very accurate, but most of them are pretty accurate. And
you would pick up on that. I'm curious if those were not accurate then.
It's very simple things, like some of the head pieces weren't correct, and the dresses were not as full as they should have been, and things like that. I would argue that the costumes in Muppet Christmas Carol are actually more accurate.
Wow, interesting.
I know, it's shocking. But generally, like, it's fun to watch. It's very accurate. There's a lot of small things that they add in to this one that a lot of other versions don't. Like, even in the beginning, when Scrooge is walking to get to his counting house, and it shows that he goes by a blind man with a dog, and the dog moves the blind man down in the alley to get out of the way. That's in the book. Like, it's like a throwaway line that Dickens puts in about how, like, people always steered away from him. Even blind dogs would lead their owners away.
I forgot that line.
Yeah.
It's funny.
So the fact that, like, they really, you could tell, like, they loved the book when they made this, especially when you look at all the minute details. But then they also have these scenes where all of a sudden, like, Scrooge is shrunken down and being chased by a hearse and getting hit in the crotch by a bunch of icicles. Like, of those scenes, it's like, okay, you could have cut some of this.
Yes,
like,
and going back to what you said earlier about adding just superfluous. Was that what you were referencing?
Some of that stuff. But also remember, they also made this 3D.
Yeah.
So, which is very obvious.
I figured that's why they threw it in. I was like, they had to throw that in just for entertainment value.
Oh, yeah.
Because I didn't like it personally.
I also think they did some of it for some, like, comedic relief.
Which I didn't. Yeah.
Because this one definitely went darker than some of the other versions, too.
That was the one thing. I did think about that as well. Because it was right after the whole creepy scene with the Ghost of Christmas Present. And I mean, I thought it was well done.
Yeah, because in the book, he does technically die.
Yeah.
But in this one, they really lean into, like, him dying and becoming a skeleton.
I did wonder, I'm like, okay, this is for kids. Do they throw that in just to add a little, you know, emotional break?
Yeah. No, I have some conflicting feelings about the film. Like, in regards to the CGI, some of the CGI is so amazing to watch. Like, some of the cityscape scenes and stuff like that. Like, there's some things they do, I'm like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And then they'll turn around and you see something and you're like, eh.
Yeah, it's a little.
That probably could have been rendering for another couple of months. I don't know. So, like, it's definitely one of those things where I don't know if they just were running out of time and money or what, but it seems like they really leaned into the spectacle a little too much at times.
Okay.
And I don't know how much of that is the company putting pressure on him or if that is just Robert Zemeckis just having a field day, but you could tell that Robert Zemeckis really wanted to stay true to the story, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
And in interviews, he said that he thought this was, like, the best way that you could tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could, by the motion capture, you could have the actors play multiple characters, but then you can also have them playing different ages of the characters and things like that, and create this world that is its brand new thing that's not really film, it's not really theater, but it's unique. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'll be honest, I'm not a fan of the motion capture stuff myself, because I think there's an element to it that just looks weird.
Yeah.
But it was a novelty for its time, for sure. Like, it was brand new. People were like, oh, what is this? Oh, this is new. This is cool. But it's cool when you hear the actors talk about it, because they had to act out everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went in later and then they animated it.
Well, so you get to see that in the deleted scenes.
Yeah. But because it's not a film, they didn't have to worry about, like, sight lines or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could kind of go anywhere they wanted, and they could move and do things. And it wasn't like theater, where, like, even Theater in the Round, Colin Firth said, it's better than that, because you don't have to worry about people not seeing you or people seeing the back of you or anything. Like, you can just act.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he said, it's weird at first, but then when you get the hang of it, it's actually really fun and very liberating, they said.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think it's one of those things where, you know, it's fun. It's cool because there's a lot of creative freedom with it for the actors, but even the animators. Because once you get the motion capture, you could move that camera anywhere you want in the universe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with you. I found it not a big fan of that style, but I liked
what they did with it.
What they did with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they did a good job. I think they just were having fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel the same way. I know, I don't know how you feel about this film, but The Polar Express.
The Polar Express is just a fun watch.
Yes.
Like it's nonsense.
But I feel like so many people hate it because of the style. And I feel the same way. I know people, when I mentioned this version of it, of Christmas Carol, they felt the same. That's so creepy.
Yeah.
Oh, you watching that? I'm like, yeah, it's not that bad.
No, I mean, I think it's only a little creepy because it's a little hyper-realistic.
Yeah.
But it's also, you could tell it's not real. Mm-hmm. And so there's this dichotomy to it that is, I think, a little unnerving for people.
It is, yeah. No, I can see that.
But
going back to what you were saying about how they were able to do so much with it, the one thing that it took me a little while to realize, I knew mentally, cognitively that it was him, but I tried to see his face.
Scrooge?
Jim Carrey.
Uh-huh.
In the ghosts.
Oh, yeah. You see, I didn't know that for a long time.
Yeah.
I didn't know that he played all the ghosts.
Yes.
Because even with The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, he still did the acting for it.
Mm-hmm. And you could pick up on it slightly,
uh-huh.
But granted, it's animation, so they're able to hide his face. But
right, and then they can change it.
And they could, yeah. But eventually,
the harder one is The Ghost of Christmas Present,
yeah,
because they made him much fuller.
Yeah,
yeah. But you can tell with Ghost of Christmas Past because it looks like his face.
Yeah, that one was a little easier.
And it's him doing the Irish accent.
Yeah.
And then it's like a Scottish accent for Ghost of Christmas Present.
And the one thing I liked with The Ghost of Christmas Past was, in the novel, it's creepy.
Oh, yeah.
The description of it.
Yeah, it's weird because you never get a good understanding of what it looks like.
No, because it's...
And it's morphing.
It is. Like, yeah. It talks about there's times when it has multiple legs and multiple arms, and then there's times
no head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you get the sense of a flame.
Uh-huh. And well, it always has a light.
It does.
Yeah.
And so even though I know they couldn't... They were working with something that was hard to already conceptualize imaginatively.
Right.
I think they did a good job of taking that feeling and what little they could do and creating something weird and kind of creepy with it. That was still not uber creepy, but creepy in the sense of like weird, but not horror creepy, you know?
Sure.
I was a little kind of mixed at first when I saw the ghost, the animation and how they did it. But as time went on, it kind of grew on me.
Yeah. One of the things I do appreciate about this, for the most part, is the filmmakers really tried to be creative with how they did things. And so they really thought outside the box, which I like.
Yeah.
So like most versions, you know, when the ghosts are visiting, it's like things just kind of morph or they fly somewhere or whatever. It's usually really simple. Like, oh, it got dark and now we're lit up in another scene. Like whatever. You know, like it's usually really simple.
Yeah.
And in this one, they really lean into the fantastical elements. And I think what they did is they said, okay, well, we know what we can do, but let's look beyond that.
Mm.
And so they never really do the same thing twice when it comes to the ghosts. And I thought that was kind of fun. Because like with The Ghost of Christmas Past, he shows up and then he's like, touch my hand and I'll take you to the past, you know, all that stuff. But then like the room elongates and it like rushes in on them. And so like when they're in the real world, it's real, it's realistic. But then when he's in the dream where he's seeing all these ghosts, like anything goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so like there's like scenes will morph into each other. But then like with The Ghost of Christmas Present, it's a lot of fun what they did with them being in the room for so long, where the embers of his light will make the floor disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So then they travel and you can see everything.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of stuff they do like that's really fun. Even with The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, there's a couple ways that he'll like fall into his hand into the shadow, and then he'll like fly out of the hand in another room. And then when they're at the Cratchit's house after Scrooge finds out that Tiny Tim had passed, he's like, tell me who that man lying in the bed was. And then the ghost just like slams through the wall and the place just like obliterates and he starts falling through the sky. All these things that they came up with to transport him to different locations was really creative.
Yeah.
And really visually fun to watch. Mm-hmm. Like they really knew the medium. The one thing that I think that went way too long is the chase.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, I love the chase in the beginning. Like, I think it's really fun and thematic to, like, have the hearse chasing him.
Yeah.
But then it just takes way too long.
It did. It went on. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, get back to the story. Mm-hmm. Like, This feels like a video game now.
It did take, yeah. No, I agree. I felt that was the one time when I got taken out of the story.
Yeah.
And it was, I was in a cartoon all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas prior to that, I'll be honest, I want to say I got dust in my eye twice.
Oh, I cry. Every time I watch this movie, I will cry at least once, if mm-hmm. not twice.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll cry from sadness, and then I'll cry from happiness.
Yes.
So one of the times that I cry, one of the first, I'm going to probably cry now. One of the times I cry in this film is when Ghost Christmas Present is taking him, mm-hmm. and it starts playing Hark the Herald Angels Sing. And only because that's one of my favorite carols.
Oh, okay.
And I love how in the movie they were not afraid to lean into the Christian elements of the story.
Yes, I like that.
They'll play the carols and
where they'll even show a cross. Yes, of
like
all things,
a cross, and then with the church in the background, mm-hmm. and like they'll even reference different things. Mm-hmm. Like, and so I appreciated those for sure, but yep, yeah. when Tiny Tim dies.
That was brutal.
Yeah. And they do this really cool thing where, because the characters can't see Scrooge, mm-hmm. there's that really cool moment where Bob is walking up the stairs and then he stops.
Oh, yeah.
And then he looks at Scrooge and Scrooge looks at him and it's as if they can see each other. Mm-hmm. And Bob's looking directly at him and it's almost as if Bob is saying, like, you could have done something.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moves on and then you go upstairs and you see him with Tiny Tim in the bed. It's so sad.
So, real quickly on that scene, both in the book and in the movie.
Uh huh. Did you see what they were doing downstairs? What the family was doing?
No.
They were sewing funeral brassards for their arms.
Okay.
It's so sad.
And so when he tells them, "Where were you?" Or were you? No, you went. And then where did he go? Where did Bob Cratchit go? Where he came from?
He went to go see the grave for Tim.
Okay, because I didn't understand that in the book either, because at first I thought he had gone to visit the grave.
Uh-huh.
He did, but he just wasn't there yet.
And no, then, he went to go visit the grave sites.
Okay.
And because even in the book, he goes up by Tim's
correct.
Bedside when Tim's still upstairs.
And it because it wasn't explicit, I got confused as to, wait, is he buried already? Is he there? What's going on? So, okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I start to tear up with Ghost of Christmas Present when Scrooge says, "What will happen to the boy?"
Yeah,
and then he that line where he says, "I see an empty seat mm-hmm. and a crutch without an owner," and he asks him, "Is like, well, like, can anything be done? You know?" And he's like, "Can't we do something for him?" And then the Ghost of Christmas Present repeats the line back to him where he says, "If he's to die, let him die and decrease the surplus population."
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So there's like the moment in the movie where you could see the family, like the mom and the dad, are really concerned about Tim, but mm-hmm. they're putting on like a brave face.
Yeah.
But like you can hear like a crack in Bob's voice when he's talking about like he's getting stronger every day. And then even like the mom, like she's turned away from him, but she's looking at the camera and you can tell like she's like really upset.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The movie does a good job with evoking emotion when mm-hmm. it wants to.
Yeah, it does.
Like it definitely gets me every time I watch it.
Yeah, that and the ending.
Yeah, it's also fun because there's back to how it stays true to the book. Like there's a lot of small things that they include in it that, again, are small things that Charles Dickens just kind of offhandedly puts in when he's being transported by the Ghost of Christmas Present. There's a part where he's visiting different people in the city at the beginning, and he talks about people on the rooftop who had started a snow fight with each other.
Yes, I remember
that. And that's in the movie too,
mm-hmm.
And so I just really enjoyed those small bits. Like even when they first leave the house, you see a boy with a sled going down the alleyway, and then at the end of the movie, that's the boy that Scrooge talks to.
I didn't pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
because it's the next day, so
yeah.
The boy would have been walking by.
That's funny.
So it's things like that you can tell a lot of thought did go into the film,
mm-hmm.
and I really like that.
That's cool.
And then I think it knew how to handle. For the most part, it knew how to handle bouncing back and forth between comedy and tragedy and the darker elements.
Mm.
It's really fun because it opens and it's really fun and it's very Christmas and the music's going and it's mm-hmm. like, here's the book and here's a candle and here's Victorian England in the background, you know?
Yeah.
But then it transports you into the book and it's like, here, it's dark. It's like, Marley was dead and here's Marley and he's dead, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so you get some of the... I think it's fun that because they added this bit in for the film where it's Scrooge talking to the Undertaker and the apprentice, and it's Scrooge saying, "Yes, he's dead. Dead as a doornail." And so it introduces the fact that Marley is dead and that Scrooge knew him and that they were partners, you know. But then it's fun because it also introduces Scrooge's character right away, because it shows how like stingy Scrooge is, and that he ends up going and having to give the man money when he doesn't want to, but then going and taking the coins off of Marley's eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. That was not in the book.
No.
But
it was very well done for visuals.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a visual representation of what Charles Dickens wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was done very well.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
No, overall I was surprised. I enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
I went in very apprehensive, but I walked away. Like I said, even the ending, I walked away with dust in my eyes. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I really liked Cratchit narrates it at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I thought that was a lot of fun. It's also fun because this one's true to the original in regards to the ending, because mm-hmm. a lot of adaptations will have Scrooge go to Bob Cratchit's house for Christmas.
Like the Disney version, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of versions will do that. And there's a couple reasons why Scrooge would never have done that. One, he was not invited. He was invited to his nephew's house, and so it makes sense for the culture and the time that he would go to his nephew's house.
Yeah.
He was not invited to Bob Cratchit's house, even if he did send the turkey.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been impolite.
Okay.
And for them to have to now take care of an extra guest.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a movie standpoint adaptation, I never fault anybody for doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is fun that in this version, he actually does go to his nephew's house like in the book.
I was wondering, as I was watching, I was curious mm-hmm. how they were going to do that.
It was a little different because mm-hmm. I forgot about this. In the book, he goes before dinner, and so it's just yes. his nephew and the nephew's wife. And then all the guests come, and then each one, as they come, are surprised to see
yes,
him
I remember
there.
That. Mm-hmm.
I think it was fun in the movie how they have him approach right before. I think it's supposed to be the sister
it is,
of his niece-in-law.
Yes.
Because in the book, they talk about how she has a plump sister.
Yes.
And she's about to say, "It's your Uncle Scrooge." And so, like, as he comes in, right as she's about to say it, like, it's kind of poetic, I thought.
Yeah.
You know?
I thought it was well done, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I love how like everyone is just excited to see him.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I think that's one of the things about the spirit of the season, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it'd be very easy for people to just be upset with someone or to like make a snide remark about like, oh, so like, why would you come now or
yeah.
whatever. Like, it's stuff that we see all the time. But like the beauty of Christmas and I mean, I think you, just going back, obviously, to Christian values in general, it's like just loving your enemies, you know, mm-hmm. loving those who have said mean things to you, who have done things to you, and
yeah.
then turning the other cheek, you know.
Yeah, I agree. It's we've become a society of me.
Right. Well,
it's me.
We've always been that way, but
we
I think
have.
It's
but even more so,
worse.
Where it's yeah. like it's my feelings, what I think is important. Yeah. If you hurt me, you know, everything yeah. is evil if it goes against what I believe. Like, I even underlined a line that I think it was a deleted scene,
mm-hmm.
but they still created it, even if it didn't make it to the final movie, in which the Ghost of Christmas Present sprinkles his dust over the fighting men. I think it's slightly different in the book, where they just like bump into each other and they kind of get all grumpy. And
it was kind of an odd scene.
I think it was
a good decision to cut that one.
I agree, but I liked it. I liked what it in the book, especially, so I underlined it, and it was.
It's Christmas, basically,
it
so we're not going to fight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's how often do we see that today?
I like how he sprinkles it over the food of the poor, though.
Yes. And so
like the poor need it more.
Yeah. And Scrooge asks him about it, doesn't he? In the book?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I might start joining you on as making this a Christmas tradition. Uh-huh.
It's good. It's good. I mean, like, it's got a couple of moments that are a little weird. It definitely leans into the fantasy elements a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, even there's, like, a few things that they changed just a little bit to make it a bit over the top, you know? And, like, there's a scene in the book when they're at Fezziwig's party
mm-hmm.
where it talks about how the violinist had been playing so hard and so furiously that he stuck his face in the punch bowl to cool himself off.
Yeah.
And in the movie, what happens is he falls off. his perch into the punch bowl.
Yeah.
And so it like fulfills that, but mm-hmm. it makes it kind of more fun, you know?
Yeah. Or even the dancing of the Mr. and Mrs. Fizzywig.
Oh, yeah. It's like breaking all laws of gravity.
I thought it was something in the movie, and then I went back and read that section again, uh-huh. and I realized he actually kind of writes about that.
He does. Yeah. He does. Yeah, that's one of the things that the filmmakers do, where you can tell they actually paid attention to the book, but if you don't know the book, it just comes off weird.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, that's why I said I really love this version, because I enjoy the book.
No, me too. Yeah.
And you know, besides a few moments that are a little weird, yeah. or like drag on longer than they should or whatever, I really do enjoy this version a lot.
Yeah. No. And those moments are outside of the chase scene. They're few. And they're mm-hmm. not, like, I mean, I think one of them was when he's putting the candle, the Ghost of Christmas Past out, and he shoots up into the air.
Yeah.
My wife turned to me and she's like, that's not in the book, is it?
No.
I'm like, nope.
No. No, and it didn't need to happen, but wasn't the worst.
It wasn't, no. Because I think in the book he ends up, it says that he wrestles him until he puts him out.
Yeah. And then he just realizes he's in his room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, the worst.
Yeah, I think it's a little rough because they had set this sweeping tone from the very beginning.
Mm.
And so they were trying to be consistent with it.
Yeah.
And so they were adding these bits throughout that would help with it.
Yeah.
And so they didn't want anything to come off less than, you know?
Yeah. No, I can see that.
Because they have these really amazing scenes where they just go throughout the whole city.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't need to be in there, but it really sets the scene and it really helps you to understand a little bit more.
And I appreciated that. But that was another thing I forgot to mention when the writing of the book. I read somewhere that he would spend his evenings or afternoons walking London town.
Uh-huh.
Up and down the streets, sometimes
like
20 miles a day.
Yeah.
Just so he could get a sense of what was going on, so as he wrote the story. Mm-hmm.
And to do research and to think about what he's going to write. And
made me wonder how much of this was something he actually witnessed, little snippets here and there.
mm-hmm. The only other thing I thought that was funny is that Robert Zemeckis says that it's his favorite time travel story.
Oh.
And it's part of the reason why he got into time travel stories. And knowing he's the one that did Back to the Future.
Yep. Same, the music. Same music.
Oh, well,
composer?
He uses him a lot.
Okay.
He uses Alan Silvestri a lot. Yeah.
So the music did not stand out to me, but part of me wanted to go back and actually listen to it.
So the soundtrack is actually really good.
Is it? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I wanted to see what it sounded like, because I think I was so... Mm-hmm. At one point when I saw, Alvin Silvestri, okay, I'm going to try to listen to the music.
Yeah, I like his music.
I do too. So I tried to listen to the music, but I think I got so wrapped up in the movie.
Sure.
It kind of went to the background.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe I'll play you something after.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah. No, I enjoy it a lot. Okay, so fun little bit here. In the original manuscript,
mm-hmm.
this is a misconception by some people. So in the original manuscript, when Charles Dickens wrote the story,
mm-hmm.
he forgot to tell the readers whether or not Tiny Tim died.
Oh.
But there's a misconception among people that he meant to kill him off.
Oh, okay.
As far in the research that I come across, that is not something that was the case,
mm-hmm.
so much as he just forgot to actually say whether or not he lives.
Okay.
It's in the story itself. It's insinuated that if Scrooge changes his ways, that Tiny Tim will be okay. But it's never outright said in the book what happens to him in the end.
Mm-hmm.
He just says, I will help your family.
Okay.
And so when the manuscript was sent in, I guess they told him, like, we need to say something. Like, you need to let people know he's okay.
Yeah.
And so that's why in the book, in all caps, he says, Tiny Tim, who did not die.
That's cool.
Uh-huh. I did notice that change, though, for this movie, though. Because
mm-hmm.
in this version, he says, and Tiny Tim, who got well.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of who did not die.
That's
funny. At some point he has to die.
Yeah. No, I got... So, on a intellectual level, I've been kind of looking at authors and whether they're deterministic or whether they're, not deterministic. And because of Tolstoy, just because I'm reading Tolstoy right now, and I know he's very deterministic in his...
Explain that to our listeners.
So, basically, that things are going to play out a certain way and events will naturally lead to certain conclusions. So in this case, determinism would say that Tiny Tim is slated to die no matter what. And,
It's kind of similar to fatalism.
Yes. You know, it's, you can't change history. You can't change the way things are going to play out.
Mm-hmm. Everything's for a purpose.
Yes. Yes.
This was meant to happen this way.
And some podcasts I've been listening on Tolstoy lately talks about how...
Fatalism's very dangerous.
What's that?
Fatalism's very dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. And that was one of the criticisms of him, is that he was a great writer, but he's too deterministic. And so, because I just heard that recently, I was like, I appreciated Dickens' inserting of this, of the uncertainty. You see this in both the movie and the book when he's asking the ghosts of Christmas Future, you know, can things be changed?
Are these the shadows of things that can happen, or shadows of things that will happen?
Yeah. And the ghost does not, well, he doesn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's also a fun change, is I think a lot of people, this time around, I read it differently than I have in the past. And one of the things I think people get wrong about Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come in the book, at least, is he's foreboding, but he's not, like, evil.
Correct.
Like, he's not necessarily the embodiment of death, per se.
Mm-hmm.
And because even in the book, like, you can, there's a part where Charles Dickens talks about how he put out a sympathetic hand.
Mm.
Whereas in a lot of the film versions, like, he's much more malevolent.
Yeah, even in this one.
Oh, he was much more malevolent.
Yeah.
Which I think works fine.
Oh, yeah. No, visually, I think it's fine.
Because it's kind of like you're scaring them straight, you know?
Yeah. Because even the addition of the coffin scene. I know that's in both Mickey's Christmas Carol and this one. But it's
It works in both versions, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I like that.
Yeah, because in the book...
Hope.
In the book, he's reaching out... The Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come reaches out a sympathetic hand to him, and it's like shaking. It's like it's upset because the Scrooge is upset.
Mm-hmm.
And then Scrooge says that the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come like slowly became his bedpost.
Okay.
And then he realized, oh, I'm at home.
And the other thing about the ghosts, the first and the third ghosts, so the past and the future, I get the impression, I know for the past, but for the future as well, I get the impression that they're personal ghosts. They're tied to Scrooge.
Okay.
Whereas the present is everyone. He's there. He talks about his brothers. He talks about, you know, for all Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
But the past tells
him... He has
him,
over 1,800 brothers.
Yeah. But the past one specifically says that it's his past, Scrooge's past.
Correct.
And so I wondered the same thing about the future. Was it general for everyone, or was it just Scrooge's potential future?
Well, you know, that makes sense, because if you're also thinking about it from the standpoint of Charles Dickens, right?
Yeah.
Like why he was writing the books.
Mm-hmm.
He was really trying to... Part of the reason why he was really emphasizing Christmas in the books is because he was trying to get people to have a heart and to invest in other people who really need it.
Correct, yeah.
He's using Christmas as a vehicle for that.
Yeah.
Like, it's true and it's real, but he's also using it for a purpose.
No, overall, I enjoyed both. I'm glad we did this.
Mm-hmm. It's a good one.
It was.
Well, anything else that you want to talk about this, or are you good? Did we exhaust it?
Everything I can think of.
All right. So do you want to do favorite characters first?
Go for it.
All right. I think my favorite character in the book maybe will be Bob Cratchit.
Okay.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like Bob. I think he's long-suffering and patient and kind and sad.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, is able to, despite his circumstances, have joy and look on the bright side when he can and all that.
Okay.
In the movie... I've always had I've always had a soft spot for Belle. I always felt kind of sad for Belle, but also happy because she has a happy life after she leaves him.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could maybe just Scrooge for the movie, I guess. I guess.
Okay. For me, it's a little. It's almost a reverse of that. I think for me in the novel, it would be Scrooge.
Okay.
And then in the movie, but instead of Bob Cratchit, in the movie, I really liked Colin Firth.
Okay. Well, you see, he's my backup.
Okay.
Because
nephew.
Yeah, I've always liked Fred.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked Fred.
I almost chose him for the book. Almost.
Mm-hmm.
But Scrooge in the movie, I think he did a good job. I think Jim Carrey did really well. He kept himself from going over the top. But I felt like a lot of the side characters, the background characters, not background, but the side characters, they did an amazing job too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot that happens in the film.
And I get that, for me, Fred is less, not that he's pretentious in the novel, but I felt like there was a little more, I don't know what it was, but a little more something that turned me off in the novel than it did in the movie.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So then, ratings.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. So how would you rate the film between 1 and 10? 1 being, I wish I never watched this, and 10 being, this is the best.
Okay. So, because of the addition of the scenes, uh-huh. the chase scene, mm-hmm. I will dock a half a point.
Oh, okay.
To bring it to a 7.5.
Oh, I thought you were going to dock a half point and make it 9.5.
No. And because of the animation. Okay, let me rethink this.
Okay.
Because that's the hard part. Is like, it's not like The Grinch where I'll probably watch it only if it's on TV. This one I actually could see myself putting on and mm-hmm. watching.
Like pursuing it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, I do. I pursue it. I'll watch it at least once a year.
So I'm going to bump it up by 1 point and give it an 8.5.
Look at you.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. I'm just going to give it a solid 8.
Okay.
I know that's less than you, which never happens.
I know. This is a first.
I know. But I think it's a good solid 8.
Okay.
It definitely makes me emotional, and I enjoy watching it. I look forward to watching it.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a couple things about it that just could have easily been fixed,
yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
But no, I loved it. It's great.
Yeah.
So this is the time where we get to talk about what type of adaptation is this. And so for our listeners out there, if you have not listened to our podcast before, welcome. Glad you're here. Merry Christmas. And but otherwise, go back and listen to our trailer where we talk about what type of adaptations we've come up with. There's 4 types. There's true to source material. There is expanded. There's message driven. And there is artistic. And so if you're interested in knowing more about those, go and give that a listen. But Romy, for this 2009 film, what would you give it? What would you say? What type of adaptation is this?
I would have to say it's the closest we've had, I think, almost so far to the true to source material.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would say it's artistic true to source material.
Okay.
I'm going to give this one a blend.
So I almost wanted to say that, but I want to hear why you did.
I think just because they were true to the source material, and yet they really kind of went over the top with the visual medium.
Okay.
And they added things in that are not in the books but are still true to the book.
Mm-hmm.
And like I think in like I said, how they did like those moments with the ghosts, like how they would transition, yeah. And yeah. Like how the Ghost of Christmas Present would transport, and having those moments like with Scrooge and Bob looking at each other after Tim passed, and things like that, like mm-hmm. being able to use what is true about the books but making it its own for the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like on par with some of the other artistic ones that we've talked about,
yeah.
But. You know, I think the other argument would be you could say it's expanded just by like how they like had him do all these crazy things, but
I didn't feel like there was enough of that to call it expanded.
No,
yeah.
That's why I think it's just it was artistically done.
Yeah, no, yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah, okay. But it's definitely the closest to faithful to the mm-hmm. true source material.
Yeah, cool.
All right. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed this one.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Just one more thing that you can say that I got you to try.
Yes.
All right, so catch us next year where I'm sure, unless we come up with a better one, we'll talk about one of the other adaptations for A Christmas Carol.
Yes.
Or maybe we'll do a bonus one sometime, I don't know. But let us know what you thought. If you think that we missed something or we were wrong about something, or if you just want to, you know, wish us a Merry Christmas, we'll take it.
Yes, definitely.
And this will probably be the last one for this year, so we'll catch you next year.
Yes, thank you for joining us, and we both want to wish you a Merry Christmas.
All right.
And we'll see you next year.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please follow or subscribe. Maybe leave a review, or just share us with friends and family.
We would also like it if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromy@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.